Alrighty. So, the question was about this hierarchy of needs, whether it's actually a hierarchy or it's an absolute. Did I get your question right? Yes.
At all times, I mean,
yes. So this is, it's like, it's not a hierarchy in terms of what is more important. It's a hierarchy in terms of what's the foundation. Look at this like a foundation of a building. And the order in which they're in may not be the same order for you. It depends on a lot of different things. I mean, for many people, interdependence is much more important, or much more foundational, let's not use the word important, because they're all important, much more foundational than play, fun, or recreation. You know, this one, like love, may be just like right there above the physical. So I don't want to present it as in an absolute, let me take this off. Whoops, it is entangled. I don't want to present it, this order is absolute. In fact, wires do have a tendency to get tangled, especially when I put them on the wrong way. Yeah, thank you. All right. Hey, look, I made a knot. This rascal wire, it's a demon wire. I know. It's actually, I'm demonstrating the different D's sometimes. Okay, I'll put that over here. The main thing to understand is these are basic needs we all have. Whether they're in this order or not, I mean, Krishna consciousness is the top. And for a pure devotee, when Krishna consciousness is satisfied, you know, they can transcend the bodily needs. But this is, I'd say this particular order fits me. I'm being honest about it. For me, as you can see, by the way, I give the seminar that play, fun, recreation, humor are probably more important than everything else. Actually, I give a whole seminar on laugh yoga and laughter, which is really nice. Because by laughing, you can increase the immune cells in your body. Did you know that? Like the T cells and the killer cells and all that. Increase that and you oxygenate your body. You can think better. It's an amazing technique. And many, many businesses, actually in India, they have this laugh yoga has become very popular. Before the people go to work in the morning, they actually do a lap yoga session and their productivity increases by 20 to 50%. So you try that in the temple before, Mangalarti. Everybody laugh a lot and then blow the conch shell. Don't laugh at that time, that's not appropriate. So that's a good question. And this is more or less my individual expression, although I do understand that for most people, these needs have to be met before you can go anything higher. I mean, I would say this is foundational right here, your physical needs. Air, food, water, touch, rest, shelter, protection, and movement. It's okay? Any other questions or... Questions? Okay. There's different strategies. You can form a NVC or an EC group where you practice these things because it does take practice. You can practice them yourself as a sadhana when dealing with people because In this world, we are dealing with people generally, yourself and myself, we're dealing with people all day long, interacting, so we can be a little introspective. But it's always better, not always better, but generally better to have other people you can practice with and discuss it with. And maybe there's an NVC group here within Chicago. I'm sure there's NVC groups in Chicago. Even if they're not devotees, you won't become contaminated, don't worry. Even if they're not devotees, you can bring them to Krishna consciousness. I mean, in my NVC training, I was the only, I don't want to call myself a devotee, because that's wrong. I probably said the devotee should not call himself a devotee. Did you know that? One time a devotee wrote a Prabhupada a letter and said, called himself a devotee, and said, Prabhupada said, devotee never calls himself a devotee. I mean, obviously, in ordinary conversation, if someone says, are you a devotee? You say, no. It doesn't make sense. But as far as self-identification, I'm aspiring to serve a servant of a servant of a servant of the Lord. So I've had experience when I went to this NVC conference, or intensive, that people started to get interested in Krishna consciousness. You know, they were interested in my diet, why was I vegetarian? I talked to them about reincarnation. And I got invitations to visit people from all over the world. Interact with people. And I didn't really have time to take up, but I had invitations in Australia. We had people from Australia, from Europe, and I made friends with people. And when a Vaishnava makes friends, or a person aspiring to be a Vaishnava makes friends, without, you know, revealing your mind and confidence to someone who's not Krishna conscious, then the person naturally takes prasadam, he comes to Krishna consciousness, so you may want to investigate. I'm sure that there are NVC groups here. Chicago. It's a major city. So you can even look that up on the internet. There's this CNBC, the main internet page for NBC? Well, you can Google it, but it's cnbc.org or com. And it'll enable you to bring people to Krishna consciousness, too. That's what I found. I mean, this is also a, I wouldn't say technique, but a mentality that can help us connect to people, and people will appreciate it, because many times I've heard this comment about devotees, you have the most personal philosophy, but you don't act in that way. You're very judgmental. So this actually brings our philosophy down to earth, or within our own actions. It's a practical way. And Prabhupada was very concerned on all levels, and compassionate on all levels with people. You know, sometimes devotees say, if we see people hungry, that's their karma. You've heard that expression before. But Prabhupada, when he saw people, or saw children fighting with the dogs for food, and they were fighting with the dogs over these plates, the leaf plates the devotees were throwing away in Sridhar Mayapur, Prabhupada started crying. And Prabhupada said, no one should go hungry within something like 10 miles or something like that of Sridhar. 3 miles? Yeah, whatever it is. I mean, the point is, no one should go hungry. Because Prabhupada also stated sometimes that no one can take up Krishna consciousness if they're hungry. So we should be concerned on all levels. And we see in India and other places, many of the churches and other organizations, they made members by showing compassion to others. You know, one of the reasons there's so many Christians in India, or, you know, not a lot, but there's so many Christians in India because the Christians said that we'll accept you no matter what your caste is. You have the Brahmins, the ritualistic Brahmanas, you know, very much caste conscious. And because they were caste conscious, they excluded a large segment of the population. You know, the outcasts, scheduled castes, whatever you may call. But they excluded a large percentage of the population. And then you had this other group come in, you know, the Christians or Muslims or whatever. Of course, the Muslims did a lot of things by force, too. That's another issue. But the Muslims also, they were more inclusive. And they established schools. I'm not saying, you know, the schools trained people up in other things, too. But they established schools. They gave medical help. The Christians established many schools. And that brought people into Christianity. Because the majority of people in this world are not philosophical. I mean, it's really hard to find a philosophical person in this world. Most people are functioning on the basis, you know, of feelings. And you see that in the political situation in America. If people were philosophical, we'd have a different government. You know, people were intelligent. You know, it's, what can I say? Kalo Shudra Sambhava. Just about everybody in Kali Yuga is Shudra. What Shudra means, basically Prabhupada defined Shudra as a person who laments. Shochati Kanchati, lamenting and hankering. So if we address people's basic needs when approaching people, like if we go to the hospitals, like every other religious group does, and counsel people, then we'll keep our people and we'll make many more devotees. We should be known as the most compassionate, loving organization. I mean, that should be one of our mottos, isn't it? Compassionate, loving, not telling people they're not the body because they're in pain. So it's important, even strategically, it's important to carry out Lord Chaitanya's mission. And what did Lord Chaitanya do? He embraced the leper, Vasudeva. He embraced the leper and cured the leprosy. You know, it's not that he said, hey, that's your karma. I mean, sometimes in order to teach a lesson, there's this Gopal Chapala. You know the story? Gopal Chapala had offended Srivas Thakur by putting the ingredients of Durga worship right outside his door. And so as a result, Gopal Chapala got leprosy. And then he approached Lord Chaitanya and said, please, you're the most munificent Supreme Personality of Godhead, please forgive me. And what did Lord Chaitanya say? Does anyone know? What? No, but there's more he said than that. More than that. No. He said, I curse you to be bitten by those same worms for many lifetimes. That's when the Chaitanya, you remember the story now? I curse you to be bitten by that. You know, so, where's the compassion? But Lord Chaitanya was compassionate because sometimes tough love is compassionate. Because if you placate people, if he had cured the leprosy, he wouldn't have taught a lesson to this guy. And he did cure the leprosy when this person took shelter of Srivas Thakur and begged for forgiveness. So sometimes something seems to be not compassionate, but Lord Chaitanya always had someone's best interest in heart, even though it was heavy. And you see, Prabhupada was like that too. He knew exactly what to do according to time, place, and circumstance. But his intention was compassion. This is an important lesson for us. It's not that, you know, you both become, you know, very soft with everything. I'm okay. Like Prabhupada, another funny story is, I was with Prabhupada one time, this is Los Angeles, and Prabhupada was giving a lecture. And one of the first things he said, he was commenting, of course, on Yato Pat, Tato Mat, you know, Yato Pat. And there was a book in English called I'm Okay, You're Okay. Maybe you've heard this lecture before. Prabhupada sat down on the Vyasasana. One of the first things he said is, they say, I'm okay, you're okay. We say, I'm okay, you're not okay. So compassion doesn't mean placating or being soft in any way. It means having the person's best interest in terms of their needs in our heart, how to meet their needs ultimately to get them to Krishna's lotus feet. So don't apply compassion in a stereotypical way. It has to be focused. As we read from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, from the Bhakti Loka, in bringing people first to the mode of goodness, you know, up through the modes, whatever strategy is required. Like Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was arranging for meat to be served to the Britishers who were going to come to Srinam Mayapur. You know that story? He was arranging for meat to be served. Prabhupada, in his Bombay temple in Juhu, he wanted to have a smoking room. I mean, probably none of you are aware of that, but I was there, I know. Prabhupada said, let's have a smoking room so people will feel comfortable coming to the temple. Not that they smoke in the temple room, but, you know, there's a separate room for smoking. And so you find that compassion requires a lot of strategy. But the intention is the important thing. And Prabhupada was very compassionate. He adjusted so many different things to be compassionate. You know, 16 rounds instead of 64. Ladies living in the Brahmacharini ashram. You can go down that line of what Prabhupada allowed. Okay, any other questions before we start this afternoon session? That's a good introduction. Yes. That's good. And first of all, I wanted to thank you for sharing that because, you know, it's right from your heart. And secondly, I want to appreciate, that's right, I want to appreciate your desire to become Krishna conscious. I mean, this is really nice because, as Rupa Goswami says, lalyam, you know, everyone knows what lalyam is? Hankering, greed to become Krishna conscious is a very important quality. And you're exhibiting that greed, and Krishna will bless you because of that exhibition of that greed. So as far as the books are concerned, there's different strategies you can come up with to, you know, to connect with the books. And strategies will have to come from you, but your desire to connect to Krishna and understand Prabhupada's books, that's your need. That's a need, and it's a wonderful need. I wish everybody had that need.
The strategy I have is to associate with devotees, I think.
That's good. And you think outside the box, perhaps there's other strategies. I know there, I mean, I can suggest things, throw them out, and I'm not telling you what to do. But there's like online devotee associations, like, and there's also online devotee communities where they read together every morning. And, you know, you can phone in or go on the computer. So these are different alternatives.
Thank you.
I'm sure because of your desire, which is really nice. So I'm doing appreciation. I'm demonstrating nonviolent communication right now. Your desire, this is really important because He has a wonderful desire. And because of that desire, Krishna will give you full intelligence how to fulfill your needs.
That's exactly what I wanted to do. Because of my desire, Krishna will give you full intelligence and full knowledge of the Vedic literature. That's one of the things that's one of the bits of knowledge, having trouble remembering, trying to be confident in, trying to produce faith or shraddha, and the help, having help with the associated, I think associating with the devotees will help. I think practicing the Yuga Dharma, chanting the holy names of the Lord will help. I think doing all of that will help. So.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. This is, you know, let's do some appreciation. Okay. You know, to reveal your mind like that is brave. So I appreciate that. So anyone have any questions before we go on to the main topic of this final session? Yeah. But to be interested in the best interest of yourself, compassion begins at home. Yeah, there's internal empathy, there's external empathy, and yourself and others, and connect with that. Your business is to take care of your own needs first. And that means part of that is not just living up to other people's expectations. Because living up to other people's expectations means that's codependency right there. Your business is you take care of your own needs, and then you can concentrate on other people's needs. Now, we're not talking about the business field now. I have to make that clear, which was made several questions in the past. And business is business, devotional relationships and loving relationships and familial relationships are a completely different field. So in business, yes, they'll have certain expectations. You've agreed to those expectations. Stick to it if you want to keep your job. But you should do that for a higher purpose, be fulfilling your needs. If you're keeping your job and living up to other people's expectations in the job, you have to be able to connect it to your own needs, and that way it's fun or play, or at least you're happy doing it. Like I said, if you're working a job and the boss is telling you, you know, not making requests, he's making demands, but you're doing it because your need to protect your family, maintain your family is there. And I've given the example many times before, I'm not sure if I gave it in this seminar, about a lady who has to spend all day long in a booth about this size. Did I do that in this seminar? No, I didn't do it in this seminar.
In
Gita Nagari, okay. So here's, you know, there are hundreds of ladies in Chicago who have to spend 8 hours a day in a booth this size. Is that torture? They're called bank tellers. You know, and they count other people's money, which makes it even worse. I mean, if you're counting your own money, it's fun. You know, I could be in a little cage all day long. But if you're counting other people's money and having to smile at everybody, now, inevitably, in each one of those little cages or boxes or whatever you say the ladies are in, guess what? There's a picture. Did you ever look inside? And what is there a picture of? Krishna? No. sometimes if they're a devotee. There's a picture of their children, not their husband. That's a joke. Because as soon as there's children, the husband, he's just like an appendage that makes money. Right? So they're happy in there. They're doing something that really wouldn't fulfill someone's needs generally. But they're happy because they're looking lovingly at the picture of little Petunia there. I don't know what the girl's name is, but anyway. And they're thinking, oh, my baby. You know, mother's love, isn't it? Jump like that? Isn't a mother's love like that? It's the closest thing to pure love of God. So if we're doing something for out of love, and connecting to our hearts, we're like that mother there. Then you can sit in your office all day long and the boss is saying, you rascal, get to work, and you're just smiling. Because you're connected. You can do austerities. That's why devotees can do austerity, because they're connected with Krishna. And they're happy. You know, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan were doing austerities because they were connected with Krishna. They were pleasing Krishna. So with that, when you have that connection of love, you can do almost anything. You can do things that wouldn't satisfy your needs in other cases. Which is interesting. You know, just like here's another example. Mayapur and Champaka, they're serving me, even though, you know, it's really difficult. I mean, she has to cook for like 20 hours a day, you know, to sleep. Because, you know, they have some affection. They wanted to move close to me. They were ready to live in a travel trailer. Right? Because there's affection. So that love is a very powerful force. And sometimes that can actually be more foundational. That's good, answer your question. More foundational than even air, food, water, light, those other touch, you know, anything. So it's interesting talking about needs. Any other questions before we do some exercises? One of my favorite parts, no more questions. One of my favorite parts in empathic communication is the expression of gratitude part. You saw me do that in Givanagri. So gratitude, like everything else in empathic communication, nonviolent communication, is expressed using this formula. When gratitude towards someone else, when you did this, I felt that because it fulfilled my need. You don't have to go into facilitation strategy or anything like that. But it's the same process. And it really strikes people when you do that. And I'm going to give you an example how Prabhupada used nonviolent communication. How about that? Several examples. Okay, here's a letter to Bhaktadas from New Delhi. So I'm going to go over the different steps right here. I thank you very much for installing Radha Giridhari. So here's the observation. Right? And then Prabhupada says, from my childhood, I was very much fond of Radha Krishna. And now my good disciples are helping me to open up so many Radha Krishna temples all over the world. This is also observation. Here's the next sentence. It gives me so much pleasure. What is that? Feeling. Wow. I mean, Prabhupada was expert in everything. And because I'm not saying that, you know, Prabhupada studied Marshall Rosenberg or anything like that, but because he's connected to Krishna, he was expert in everything. If you read his letters, you see that he follows this process of MVC in so many cases. Now, and then, all right, so it's interesting, he's expressing his pleasure, and he also said his need, because it from my childhood, was very much fond of Radha and Krishna. That was the need. The need came first there. It's all right. And then now Prabhupada is making a request. Now introduce Rathayatra. I mean, this is so, like, according to this whole, the whole scenario here, isn't it? Now introduce Rathayatra. And then more requests. You're an expert. I want to see my disciples all over the world introduce two items, opening Radha Krishna temples and Rathayatra festivals. Please do everything cooperatively, for you will be very... Here's another one. And then he connects with our needs. You will be very happy. And your countrymen will be happy. And all living entities will be happy. Wow. That's really powerful. I mean, Prabhupada's letters are just a study in expert psychology, spirituality, all levels Prabhupada is dealing with, and compassion towards others. Here's another one. I have studied your activities while in Honolulu. That's, of course, the observation I've studied. And it gives me great pleasure to find out, heart, such a devotee qualified as you are in our society. I wish. So Prabhupada is, he's showing his need. You know, his need to have qualified devotees serving his mission. Then he says, I wish you will execute responsibilities in the future in the matter of our society's multi-activities. So there's a request there, too. Interesting, isn't it? How Prabhupada goes through this whole system. Here's another one. This one's to Amarendra, who is running for office. He said, I have studied your statements in the papers, and you have repeated my ideas at the same time sounded like a politician. I have a need for music. So, and this combination is very effective. You know, Prabhupada is expressing his pleasure. He may not say that directly. And you are the right man for this preaching work. Here Prabhupada said, they have taken you as a serious candidate, and according to your statement, you feel that you may even win. So, here's the emotion. I am very much encouraged by this political field in America. So Prabhupada's encouraged, inspired. The people there are very intelligent. Of course, this was many years ago when people were more intelligent. What can I say? After my generation, all went downhill. People, they're very intelligent. And they take your statement seriously. I do not need to tell you to push on with this work in serious concentration because I can see that you are already determined. Wow. So there's the whole process right there, illustrated by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Now, the main thing is when we appreciate someone, which we mentioned in the very beginning of the seminar, it's not praise. Remember what we said? Praise puffs you up, and it's manipulative. I mean, I'll give you an example of how I manipulate people with praise sometimes. I have one of my god brothers who has money, and sometimes I need to borrow something. So first of all, I make sure I call him on the phone after he's eaten. You never want to ask someone for something right before they eat. It's not good. So I ask him, have you eaten? And he says, yes. I said, okay, I have something to ask you. But first I want to tell you how wonderful you are. You inspire me all the time. Your classes are so ecstatic. And then after a minute of that, he says, okay, what do you want now? So that's that's manipulation. So we say this because we genuinely feel like that, and then we can make a request. If you don't genuinely feel like that, that is manipulation rather than gratitude. It can also be non-verbal. Here's another quote from Prabhupada I had here in my teacher's book. I hear from you the details of your procession. This is in regard to Rathayatra. And it is so much gladdening to my heart. There's an emotion again. Thank you very much for making Rathayatra Festival so successful. Please convey my gratitude to all the boys and girls. There's the word gratitude. and appreciation. This is the second year, and you have made a great stride in the first. And in the third year, I will hope it will be more successful. So I think I could find more examples from Srila Prabhupada, but I don't need to do that right now. So the point is also when someone expresses gratitude, what do we normally do? What do we normally say? Thank you, but there's another thing we say. What? Yeah, I don't deserve it. That's one thing, that's good. Another thing, it was nothing. That's another big one. It was nothing, because we think that's humility. But also to receive gratitude, we should take it as they're encouraging us, they're meeting one of our needs. Our need to be appreciated, it's right there. Acceptance, appreciation, closeness, community, all these, love, reassurance, respect, etc. And so, if someone voluntarily meets one of our needs, we're very much filled with gratitude. Wow, thank you. I feel really good that you did it. So, what I want to do is do an exercise. Okay. Here, this is a really heart-wrenching exercise. If some of you can get into it, at my request. Think of a person you wanted to express gratitude to, but you no longer can do it because they're not on the planet anymore. There's a person who did something for you. Observation, how you feel about it and what need they fulfilled. You're doing that particular way. But they're no longer on the planet and you lost your opportunity. You know, for many people that means father, mother passed away, or some teacher, or even a brother who happened to die before you or something like that. You know, people die in Kali Yuga at a young age. We've had a lot of very young people pass away. So, maybe I'll give you about 2 minutes to think about it, and then I'm going to ask them if someone's ready right now for someone. I can demonstrate it for you. And usually we do this in the temple room, there's a picture. But usually I do this with Prabhupada, because I feel, I know that I didn't get adequate opportunity to express my gratitude to Prabhupada while he was on the planet. So the way I would approach this would be, Srila Prabhupada, let me sit down for this one. All right, Srila Prabhupada. You came to the Western world, had 2 heart attacks on the way over. You struggled in New York, had things stolen from you, had to deal with so many devotees or people that were really different than the culture that you were used to. You did this just for the purpose of bringing us to Krishna. I'm amazed. I'm overwhelmed. I'm wordless. You know, I can't say anything about it because it's just so amazing how you've actually done this. These are my emotions, of course. And it fulfilled my need for having a purpose in life. It fulfilled my need for realizing my original spiritual nature as being blissful, part and parcel of Krishna. Thank you very much for doing this. So that would be, I mean, usually when I do it's more emotional, but I'm trying to exhibit the whole process. Because Prabhupada is no longer, I mean, he's with us, still in sound vibration. However, it's different, you know, you can't sit in front of him and have him say to you, unless, of course, you're a psychic or something, and have him say to you, thank you for your appreciation. But so we have many people like that. I think all of us have people who we can no longer approach for one reason or other. Would someone like to volunteer an appreciation along those lines? Yes.
Well,
microphone. Very nice.
I would tell him, thank you so much for loving me. Thank you so much for taking me out on the bike rides.
That's good. Specific.
Thank you so much for taking me to the bicycle museum that they have in Pittsburgh.
Mm.
Thank you so much for just being there with me in general.
Good. Thank you. That's very nice. So it really connects you. I mean, when we do this exercise, even if the other person is not there, it connects us with them. You know, so when I did it with Prabhupada, of course I was doing it to exhibit the process to you, I just felt more dedicated to Prabhupada. And of course gratitude was there, but I just felt like, you know, wow, now I really have to dedicate my life, do something for Prabhupada. All these thoughts were coming into my mind as I was expressing the gratitude. Yeah. Oh, I thought you had something. Anyone else? Yes. Jumpa God.
Yeah. And then
Wonderful. So what needs did everybody hear there? I'll start out. Inspiration. Hope. Your confirmation she's on the right track. I mean, so many needs that Yamuna, remembering Yamuna Devi or hearing about Yamuna Devi met for Champaka. And so that's very powerful. And how do you feel now that you've expressed that gratitude, appreciation? But emotions, what sort of emotions do you have?
Oh, grateful, satisfied.
Some sadness too, or that you didn't get a chance to?
No, I think I already went through that.
Okay. Happy.
It's an opportunity for me to feel happy again.
Okay. See how happy she is, sharing the gratitude? Wouldn't we all like to smile like that? That's good. So someone else want to share some gratitude? It's very powerful. Nobody else. Oh, yes, gratitude. For someone who's not, you're not able to share with anymore. Pig pen. That's a famous story. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's wonderful. Hare Bol. So, before we have other people, this is going to be spontaneous. I hope Nityananda Prabhu doesn't mind this. Because before we have other people express appreciation from people, like four people they can't express appreciation for, would you be willing, oh my God, to express appreciation for your wife? Could we do that? Would you be willing to do that? And for taking on the service of being temple president? Is that too much for you? Or? Oh, so if you don't want to do it, sorry. Well, if you don't feel comfortable, it's all right, because I can see it. Okay. No, it's all right. See, he's already expressed appreciation. Notice that? It's not words. Thank you very much. It's not words. He's really appreciative. You know, actions speak louder than words. So, that's okay. I mean, you've already expressed your appreciation. There you go. You see what a nice relationship you have. Arrivo. Very good. Very good. Thank you. I'm sorry for putting on the suit, but like that. Does anyone else have someone that they'd like to express appreciation for that's no longer with them? And following the process of observation, feelings, and needs, is no longer with them at this particular point. Because we never know when we're going to lose the association of someone. And as I mentioned before, you weren't here before, but I mentioned before, like with Prabhupada, I did not get enough opportunity to express appreciation for Prabhupada when he was on the planet. And you never know. None of us thought that Prabhupada was going to leave the planet. You know, we just thought, you know, this is Prabhupada's pastimes. He's getting sick, then he gets better, because we have to do these 24-hour kirtans, and that's Prabhupada's pastimes to draw our love towards him. But especially as 24-year-olds, we didn't consider that people pass away. That's one of the problems with being young. And so I lament every day I didn't get more opportunity to either associate with Prabhupada, more opportunity to appreciate Prabhupada, more opportunity to please Prabhupada when Prabhupada was pleasant, present. So do we have anyone else who wants to share? Oh, you want to share? Great. Little group of us were in Brooklyn Temple and started to do Wow, that's powerful. Thank you very much. Wow. Okay. Wow, thank you very much. That's powerful. That's powerful. So, any other gratitude? Yes. Haribo. Very nice. Very, very nice. Anyone else want to do gratitude for someone they can't talk to right now or can't express gratitude right now? Okay. See how powerful it is, this gratitude. So what I suggest is that whenever we do GBC meetings, we go around the room and express gratitude to each other. And that really will soften the atmosphere and develop loving relationships. It's one of the most powerful exercises in nonviolent communication or empathic communication. Not just for people who have passed away. I mean, don't wait till someone passes away. Do it now. So any questions about that before we go on to something else? Yes. Yes, sir. That's right.
But the picture towards us is ambivalent sometimes. The words, the speaking have no much language sometimes. Mm. So in that case, what can you do?
If they don't express the gratitude or...
If they don't express gratitude or they don't seem happy or not even say nothing about it, then you have done something with this one.
Then you give... Well, then we do internal gratitude. That's another very powerful thing. That when we pat ourselves on the back, not really. We say, when I, this is very important too. That when I did this, when I helped, let's use Mayapur Chandra again. And so I helped Mayapur Chandra, We have one funny thing. He sometimes he offers obeisances and I jump on his back. But anyway, we have a very unusual relationship, as you see. So let's say when I help him, and let's say he doesn't express gratitude or anything like that, if I have the expectations of gratitude, I'm demanding that from him. So it's really important. The point you're making is good. That I will go internal and say that I'm very happy I was able to do this particular thing. Let's say he was in the hospital or something and I went to see him. And I was able to fulfill my need for compassion by doing it. And I, basically thank myself. Yes, I'm very happy that I did it. There's nothing wrong with that. Because it's connected, not that I'm wonderful. That's a different thing. Like the same thing when you're talking about someone else, you don't say you're wonderful, you're fantastic, you're great. Thank you for doing something specific to fulfill my need. And I'm very happy that I did something specific for whatever, whoever, because it fulfilled my need for whatever, connection, for love, for community. And that's gratitude. I can meet my own needs. That's one of the main things about the teachers of nonviolent communication. You are responsible for fulfilling your own needs. No one else is. Because otherwise it's a demand and it doesn't connect you to anyone. If I have a need, like I mentioned, if I have a need for food and she doesn't want to cook, it's fine. I cook. Sometimes it's really interesting. Sometimes the husband's demanding the wife to cook. And, basically, I'll tell you a funny story in a second about that. Basically, she feels that demand there. That he's just like, you have to cook. And she's thinking in her mind sometimes, why doesn't he learn how to cook? So recently what happened is one of my disciples, well, his wife left him. And he's about 55 years old. And so his mother, who's still in India, says to him, you got to find another wife. And I said to him, why do you have to get married again? He says, my mother's word, I won't get it. Nobody will cook for me. I mean, that's not a good reason to get married. I mean, there are other good reasons, like companionship and love and support and all those things like that, but... And so finally he agreed with his mother. He was getting married at 55. So, anyway, that's another issue. No vanaprastha for him. So, anyone else have questions about gratitude before we move on to something else? Yes. What's that?
You're asking me to show gratitude for something and I didn't say anything. So,
and this is what I do. No, he heard that as a demand. That's the problem.
I was going to be a little shy, so I didn't want to. But actually, first, you said that if somebody was left, I have a shoulder up that. Because growing up in this time means, especially if you don't have a family, I had, of course, I had my brothers. So Prabhupada was my father growing up. It was internal. And I was always very grateful that I could feel him taking care of me. And then he gave me you. Thank you very much, Prabhupada.
How do you go? Yeah, Mayapur is my son-in-law. He doesn't like that. No, he's my disciple. Chambaka is. So sometimes I introduce Chambaka is my daughter and Mayapur is my son-in-law. It's interesting. So any other questions about that? You have questions, yeah. Well, it's advisable to think of what you're thanking the person for. You can say it specifically, like I said, body language, tone of voice is everything. You may not say anything. I mean, like we saw with Nityananda Prabhu, he was expressing his appreciation for his wife, and there was no words, no tone of voice, but it was extremely powerful, extremely powerful. So it's the consciousness that's the important thing. If you have the right consciousness, the body, language, and everything will follow. You don't have to do something with your body. Like we talked about, I think the first day, we talked about counseling. When you counsel people, it's not a question of where you put your hands or where you sit like that. It's a question of what your attention is or where your intention is. You have to be connected with someone. You could sit like this, not like that, but you could sit like this, you know, with the hands down like this, which is against all the rules of counseling, and be connected. Or you could sit like this, which is following the rules, and be disconnected. You know. That's everything's a matter of consciousness. Consciousness of your feelings, needs fulfilled, needs not fulfilled, someone else's needs, what someone else needs, and connecting with people, because that's the main need, to connect to people. Need for community, connection, love. All right, any other questions? Well, okay, so maybe we should go on something a little different. So I'm going to refer to something in my book. Now, if any of you are interested in following up, the book has all this information with more quotes in it. Quotes from Prabhupada and previous acharyas like that. Now, here's something about leadership. And it's based on Prabhupada's quote. This is a very interesting quote. Prabhupada said, if you go to Lanka, you'll become Ravana. Anyone's heard that quote before? It's an interesting quote. If you go to Lanka, you'll become Ravana. In other words, if you put it in common language, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So this, actually, here's the saying. This is in Bengali. Yaya se Lanka se hoye Ravan. Which means anyone who comes to Lanka, he becomes Ravan. So there's many examples of people. This is an example of basically the designation and being attached to your designation or the judgment. Remember we were talking about judgments or right up there in the middle? So we put designations or labels on ourselves and begin to identify with those particular labels. So here's some studies. There was once upon a time, there was a famous Stanford prison experiment done by someone named Zimbardo. Anyone's heard of that experiment before? You heard about it. So in this experiment, he wanted to see why in jails people, the prisoners, are tortured by the jailers. So he took students, two groups of students, and he assigned them labels, designations. He said, one group, you're jailers. In other words, you're in charge of the jail. And the other group, you're prisoners. Okay, so you had two groups. And he actually had a mock prison in the basement. This is in Stanford. He had a mock prison. And he had the jailers act like real jailers, you know, a lot of people in jail. And he had the prisoners act like real prisoners. But what happened after some time was that the jailers started to beat the prisoners. He didn't tell them to do that. But because they identified with their particular designation, they acted in a certain way. Important. This is a very important point, because when one gets a position, studies show, I'm reading from the book, that when one gets power, one begins to see people as objects. This doesn't happen all the time. Sees people as objects for fulfilling one's strategies rather than as persons. This is the danger of having a position, whether in a spiritual organization or not. And you see this with all sorts of abuse scenarios that occur, whether in the political field. You know, right now, so many things are coming out. There's this, what is it called, the Me Too movement. Anyone's heard about that before? Hashtag Me Too. And generally, it's people with power who can look at others and think that they can get away with anything due to their particular position. So this is particularly a problem in religious societies. I just wanted to point that out. We're not going to do any exercises about this. So one has to be careful when they have responsibility in a Krishna conscious movement over others. And you have to consider yourself to be servant leaders. My godbrother Bhaktachirthamars was very fond of this particular designation. That we're always servants. If someone's sitting on the Vyasasan, That's his service. The next day he could be washing the pots. And if he sees any distinction internally between the two, externally there's a distinction. If he sees any distinction internally between the two, then he's fallen. Like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, if you think you're guru, you're a guru. You know, you're like you're a cow or an ass. So in Krishna consciousness, as we progress, as we take over responsibility, we have to be careful about those judgments or designations. That's another chapter in the book. One of the other chapters I wanted to deal with, unless I have any questions about that. Any questions about servant leadership? Okay. Another part of the book, main part of the book, deals with, and we can use my teacher's book for this, deals with how to raise children in an empathic way. Is anyone interested in that, Brahmacharya? Okay. Let me go over this. This is following the same particular dynamic we're talking about. Now, the first thing we have to do, or we don't have to, when we're thinking about raising children, is we think about the long-term goals. What do we want children to become or be when they get older? Not in terms so much about their occupation. So there's different ways that we can guide, I'm not using the word control, but guide children in their spiritual lives and also in their material lives. And some of them are empathic and some of them are not. So the main way that people utilize to discipline, control, guide children is the control issue, the control way of threats. We talked about this before, threats and rewards. Now that's the same way that animal trainers use to train animals. Like, and if you go to any of these seaquariums or where they have these dolphins that jump up in the air, anyone's been there? What do they do when the dolphin does his thing? They give him a little fish. So if you train children in that way, then we mentioned previously about B.F. Skinner. B.F. Skinner is a behavioral psychologist. And his idea was that it doesn't matter what consciousness people have or whether they're conscious at all. You train them up with rewards. And so he did that with his daughter. He trained his daughter in a very mechanistic way with rewards, and she became a behavioral psychologist too. That was his whole idea. So, in EC, we train or we, let's say train or guide people using empathy. And that takes more time. Other methods of discipline, such as threats, rewards, punishment, are very easy to do. So what does that mean by taking more time with the children when you're raising children? It means sitting down with them, explaining, going through, let's say, their needs, and explaining to them how certain strategies will be useful in fulfilling their needs, even with little children. This is actually very important, because the statistics show that the more controlled authoritarian ways that parents deal with children, the more disruptive behaviors they will have later on in life. The more they exert control by aggression or punishment. And so the studies show there'll be more anger, revenge. It reinforces the whole concept of the power is what is important in this world. So the children should be dealt with working with rather than working or punishing or controlling mechanisms. So anyway, that's the main thing. I have a whole seminar on that. I just wanted to touch upon it for a few seconds. Anyone have any questions about that? Questions about raising children? Yeah, you have a question. using this whole process of MVC. Punishments. I think, first of all, we have to transform ourselves in learning how to be more empathic with each other, and then utilize the same mentality, the same process for dealing with the children. In other words, find out what their basic needs are. And of course, if you can explain to them how certain strategies, with them you may have to be more, let's say, suggestive of strategies. Explain how certain strategies will not work to fulfill their needs and certain strategies will work to fulfill their needs. It means taking time. Also, another thing that's suggested by Marshall Rosenberg and also another person named Alfie Cohn, I don't know if any of you heard of him, is that when you integrate the children into your family environment, we're not just talking about education right now, and if there's decisions to be made in the family, like who's going to, where you're going to go on vacation, you have them as part of the decision-making process. Obviously, you don't let them control everything and make all the decisions in life, but you bring them in. They feel teamwork. And then, because of that, they'll actually naturally cooperate more. And there has to be, in other words, don't disconnect, as we talked about yesterday. Don't disconnect the activity from there shouldn't be extrinsic rewards for the activity, there should be intrinsic rewards for the activity. Explain that to the children. That studying is enjoyable. Why? To learn things. Not because you're getting money. Not because you're getting grades. Not because you're getting appreciation. But because the studying in itself is valuable. And if everything's explained intrinsically how different activities to the children, they'll be more likely to be happy campers, so to speak, as they're doing their activities. Okay? In other words, behavior should be dealt with intrinsically rather than extrinsically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And on one hand, as a disciple, the children also, they really want to please and they're very loyal, mm-hmm. to their parents. And then they have seen, I want to serve my spiritual master. That there is an intrinsic desire to be Krishna conscious.
Mm-hmm.
But that comes because of the nature of the service, it also
Right.
And sometimes a part of it, I'm going through this seminar, I'm thinking to myself, there's certain senses that I want to speak up and go in there to my spiritual master. I think here is, I can't do this, though I want to. But there's this fear that maybe the spiritual master, out of his own humility, or, you know, then I, if I'm causing you stress, I'd rather not put you in that position and then not give the service.
Mm. It's a learning process, yeah.
But at the same time, there's a fear that, you know, if the guru doesn't want to stress you out and he may not, like, bother you, you know, and then they say, oh, this is a source of inspiration.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you do in a situation like that?
I would say you have to balance it.
And exactly, I'm asking how to
balance it. How to balance it? I think it's being honest with the guru or with the authority or the parents, whatever situation you happen to be in. That, not that I can't do it, but explaining what needs you have, like I really haven't gotten slept last night for the last 5 nights, I haven't taken any rest. But I'm willing to do this if you want. And let him decide. You to say no, that empathically is very important, to learn how to say no empathically.
How to build that into the fear?
Oh, then you express that. I'm afraid that you may change my service. That's not really what I want. I think it's being open, honest, and vulnerable. If you express that fear, I really want to do this service. I'm really enthusiastic to do this service. However, this is happening too. You know, these needs are important. You know, I haven't fed my children in 5 days. You know, not really. That's being a little humorous. But I think just open, honest relationships. Our relationship with gurus, superiors, or superiors' relationship with people working on should always be open and honest. We should be real people and not simply function according to our designations. You know, for me, one of the greatest, let's say, praises or appreciations people can give is say, by saying, and see, people say that once in a while, they say, you're a real person. You know, that sounds funny. But generally, you look at people in terms of their position, but they're persons. I mean, Prabhupada was a real person. He had his needs, his likes, his dislikes. So, and it's interesting looking at Prabhupada, that sometimes we take Prabhupada's likes or dislikes as absolute. Like Prabhupada, for example, he said, I'm just giving it, this is like hermeneutics, another subject matter. Prabhupada said, potatoes are the king of all vegetables. Now, if I don't agree with, if I don't feel like that, does that mean I'm Maya, I'm blaspheming my spiritual master? I don't like potatoes. So he's a person. He has personal likes. Like Krishna's a person. Krishna has personal likes. And of course, Krishna's personal likes are absolute. He plays the flute, you know, why doesn't he play a guitar? I don't know. So, you know, if he actually was up to the times, he would learn how to play guitar, keyboard, and everything like that. So, but we see Prabhupada as a person. Your guru is a person. And then when you interact with him as a person rather than in a position, I mean, obviously there's certain respect that's there. You don't say, you know, hi, Guru Maharaj. How you doing? You know, high five. That reminds me, one time there was one of the spiritual masters was in America for the first time, and he was blessing his disciples. And he said, I bless you. And the disciple didn't understand blessing mudra. And he said, oh, high five, Guru Maharaj. So you don't want to do that. So the main thing is understand you're dealing with a person. Deal with them personally. Express your needs. I mean, My feeling is relationships should always be open like that. Otherwise, there's no relationship. And I do that with Prabhupada. Of course, Prabhupada's not on the planet, but I express what I'm feeling, what I'm needing, and you know, I try to understand what he wants of me, given those circumstances. And I have to be practical too. Okay. Thank you for that. So, any other questions? Yes. Just leave it on.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, sorry if this question is a repeat, but I was not here yesterday.
Okay, that's fine.
But then you use the word about children upbringing and other things. So sometimes I observe that the parents who are very advanced in devotional service, and sometimes the children don't even care for that. Okay, is it that the parent is missing something in need of the child, or the child has got some allergy with that? All right.
There may be, okay, that's a good question. There may be a lot of reasons for that. One is that the children may experience Krishna consciousness as taking their parents away from them. You know, you have to see it. Very important that children feel cared for by the parents. Now, sometimes in the early days, I don't think it happens anymore, the parent will be doing RT service in the temple room, and the child, little child, want to touch the parents. Don't touch me, you're moochy. You ever seen that happen?
Yeah.
You see that happen? But what does the child hear? The child doesn't think, oh, that's Krishna consciousness. That's very nice. My parent wants to serve. The child has experienced rejection. The child is equating Krishna consciousness with rejection. That's one reason. Another reason, and actually Prabhupada said the first business of the mother is child worship. It doesn't mean RT. You know, Sri Child Charanapadma Kevala Bhakta Krishadma Madanvi Savadana Mate. So, but child worship means that's the mother's first priority. I mean, she can do other things. And children need full-time caregivers. And that also has to do with sometimes people, husband and wife both have to work a job, and then they put the child in daycare. What does the child feel at that particular juncture? The child needs someone, either a relative, mother, father, grandmother, something like that, taking care of them. So the child experiences things differently than we experience things. The child experiences discipline in a different way. Let's do a little exhibition of this. Can you bring a chair? So who wants to be a child? No, not now, but I mean, who wants to act like a child? Okay, so we're going to see things from a child's perspective right now. Okay, child, get on the floor if you're a child. And I'm an adult. Here's Kumbhakarna. You know who Kumbhakarna is? And this is the perspective of a child. Go to your room. Now! Right now! You disobedient rascal! Your nonsense! Get the hell out of here! How do you feel?
I feel small.
Feel small. You feel sad, happy. Do you have a need for autonomy?
Very,
yeah, that's all right. You have a judgment now. Subjective, yeah, yeah, this is your judgment. You feel?
Subjective.
Subjective, okay, subjective, okay, got it. I thought it was subjective judgment. Subjective, okay. And that's how a child feels because he has a need for love and he has a need for autonomy, as all these other needs. So that's a child's perspective. And we oftentimes don't see things from a child's perspective. Another thing that, you can sit down now, my dear child. So, another thing that parents do, Krishna conscious parents do, is that they impose a spiritual standard on the child in terms of numbers of rounds, waking up early in the morning. And because the child, we talked about this a little bit before, whatever we were forced to do when we were kids, we don't want to do when we get older. I went one disciple in Europe who was forced to get up at 3 o'clock every morning and take care of the deities when he was 5 years old. You know, poor kid was tired. And so right now, he can't get up earlier than 8 o'clock. If I ask him to get up earlier than 8 o'clock, it's just like traumatic, you know. It's super traumatic. So Krishna consciousness has to be shown to be or made to be fun for the children. And they have to do it voluntarily. Nothing should be imposed. You have to chant. I've seen parents do every year you grow up, you have to chant one more round. And what are they hearing? You have to do it. It's a demand. And every time you make a demand, naturally, two things will happen. One thing is that people go along with you, then they lose their sense of autonomy, their sense of individuality, or they rebel. When I was a child, I rebelled and joined the Hare Krishna movement. So if you don't want your children joining the Hare Krishna movement, be nice to them. If you do want it. If you do want your children to, I mean, I said that deliberately. If you do want your children to join the Hare Krishna movement, be nice to them. Whatever you want. It should be fun and voluntary. And another thing about children, this is a very important point that I forgot to mention, is role models. Having role, people they look up to. Most of us, at least myself, I have my role model. Srila Prabhupada is my hero. He's my superhero. So what do I want to be when I grow up? Still haven't grown up. But anyway, what do I want to be is like Prabhupada. And you have your spiritual master, maybe your role model, Prabhupada. Other Vaishnavas may be your role models. It's fantastic. Your mother may be your role model. And that inspires the children. What did Prabhupada say? Example is better than precept. And that's a role model. So that's really how to inspire children. And it's still voluntary. It may not work. Children can still decide, I don't want to be in Krishna consciousness. But of the two things that determine whether a child will be Krishna conscious or not, there's two things, nature and nurture. Nature and nurture. Nature means what they're born with. Nurture means what happens afterwards, how they're nurtured, how they're brought up, either in Krishna consciousness or in any other way. And nurture is more important than nature. Krishna himself had a child that became a demon. And Krishna had to kill that child. You know the story? Bhumasura. Krishna and Bhumi had a kid. And when Krishna was Lord Varaha, there was a kid. And because of that, his bad association, he became a demon. Krishna had to kill him. Also, we've all heard the story of the Didvita gorilla, right? He was a good guy. He helped Lord Ram. But then he had bad association, and he had to be killed by Balaram. Actually, also he offended Lakshman. That's another story from the Ramayana. But the point is that the association and what happens to a child is more important than the qualities that they're born with. So we're responsible. Any other questions? Unless we want to touch on another subject matter, which is anger and how to deal with anger, but that would be very quick within the next 15 minutes. You want to do that? Okay. Anger is very easy. Anger is a feeling, right? And we don't want to blame others for making us angry. So when we experience anger, what we do is we observe what stimulated the anger rather than thinking that particular thing caused the anger. So we observe that, and of course our feeling is anger. And why are we angry? Because we have some need. And what is the need? The need for food. So this process can take care of all sorts of situations. The need for food, the need for appreciation, any one of these needs, unfulfilled needs, can be the cause of anger. And that's anger in a nutshell. Anger management, isn't it? Think about it. Take responsibility. I am angry because I have a need, not because you made me angry. Okay? So there's more to it. I have a whole seminar on anger, but I'm not going to go through the whole thing because our time is running short. Any other questions before we end? Yeah. Yes. You take a pause, take a walk. Take a walk, take a breath, take yourself out of the situation, and then process it. And take responsibility. The main problem that's there with anger is we're blaming someone else for making us angry. But it's our own need that's causing the anger. There's a difference between the stimulus and the cause. If someone says something, like we did that experiment, or the what we did yesterday with the four chairs, you remember that? The stimulus was Ajnana Pranjit, I wouldn't say insulting, sane, certainly, let's be objective. He said, you're boring, whatever. That was the stimulus. So instead of blaming him, I said, I'm responsible for my anger. So that's the whole point of denial responsibility we were talking about before, that blocks communication. So I'm responsible for my anger. Why am I responsible? Because there's a certain need that's not being met. But it takes time. You can't do it instantaneously. You just, you know, what I would say in a normal situation, if he said what he said to me, can I come back in about 10 minutes and talk to you? And he would probably say, no, I want to talk now. Did you ever hear about that? That happens sometimes. Let's work it out now. And I said, unless you want to have fisticuffs, I think it's better I take a walk right now and process this. Or, you know, I may say I have to go to the bathroom. I'd lock myself in the bathroom for about 10 minutes. But you need a breather. You need to process this. You have to what? I would say that's a good idea. Because there's different stages. I took some professional courses in anger management. Not that I had a problem with it. But this is part of my research into this, all these different areas. And they talk about different stages in anger. It's like a curve. Like a bell curve. You know, it goes up. And when it gets beyond a certain point, it's uncontrollable. So you want to be able to take a break before it gets. And sometimes it does get uncontrollable. Boom, you explode. And then you have to learn how to apologize. You would say that, I'm sorry I told you were a rascal. you know, this is objective. This is observation. I told you you were a rascal. And I'm feeling right now, because you go to the present feelings, I'm feeling really upset. You don't want to use the word guilty. You could use it, but it's generally that's a judgment. So I'm feeling really upset, and I have a need to be compassionate. I have a need to be tolerant. Would you excuse me for acting like that? So there's an NVC or an EC way of apologizing too. Yes, because sometimes the anger just takes hold of us. Especially when you're driving a car, someone cuts you off. I mean, what is the first thing you say?
I can't say
in public. What?
I can't say in public.
You always can't say in public. He's honest. You know, the first thing you say, that idiot, jackass, you know, use some words you wouldn't use in the Hare Krishna temple. I mean, it happens. Certain times there's stimulus, because we have a need. But ultimately, you understand, I responded that way because I have a need for safety, cooperation, whatever other need it is. But sometimes you do explode on the moment. Yeah. You take your time before you respond. Yeah, you take your time. The best thing is you try to catch it in the beginning and you just like take your time to understand why you are angry. You know, I am angry, I am upset because I have this need for understanding. And this particular situation is not satisfying that particular need for understanding, so therefore I can communicate that with the other person, or I can communicate that with myself, and that takes care of the anger. The anger easily dissipates if you catch it early. Yeah.
Aren't you here that anger is an enemy of the mind? It's one of the gates to hell.
Yeah, lest anger greed.
So, you know, eventually we want to get rid of anger. At this point, we have these needs that are unmet, and therefore,
yeah.
You know, we need to express
Well, I think no, there is actually productive anger. You'll be able to channel it and be productive. I mean, for example, I mean, I think in the Battle of Kurukshetra, Arjuna was angry in certain instances. I think Bhimsen was certainly angry in certain instances. So there's a productive use of anger. You channel it rather than let it be destructive. And then be able to use your intelligence. That's the mode of goodness, in order to channel it properly. Cultivate the mode of goodness. Is that all right?
I have more questions.
Okay.
On this topic of anger. I was reading in your book, you were saying suppression or repression are both...
Yeah, suppression or repression, yeah. Yeah.
And I
mind
that, you know, I've seen my older son
doing
that in his teeth.
Grinding teeth, yeah.
I'm wondering if, you know, you probably
would bring him. I'm not sure that that's the reason he's grinding his teeth. You know, I can't say that. But it's because of unfulfilled needs. And it's important to help him understand which unfulfilled needs he has. Whether it's due to anger and he has an unfulfilled need for understanding, I don't know. I would definitely go through the needs. You know, you're gritting your teeth at night and how you're feeling. You know, what is your basic emotion that you're feeling? And then try to connect. Are you feeling this? You know, with a child, you can actually do the direct process. Are you feeling this because you have a need for understanding? Or whatever. Okay? Yeah. Just general questions now, or anger if you want, because we have 4 minutes left. Analysis.
For various reasons, but it seems difficult for me to getting in sure that you can care for counselors and helps. But that might not be practical.
No, you don't need a counselor, right?
So
how you're relatively sane. So how to what? How to figure it out? Yeah. Feelings that you have, the feelings that you might turn to be negative, there are actually no negative feelings, but feelings that are unpleasant feelings you have are indications of needs not being met. So that's the first indication, and you try to connect it, and you go through the list of needs and see which ones resonate with you. I would go through the list, and that's my suggestion. I would go through the list it would be good to have a facilitator, someone help you guess at it, and certain needs will resonate with you. And then go for that. You know, one other question, we have 2 more minutes.
In the topic between couples, the wife may have certain needs and the husband may have certain needs.
Yes.
And the strategies will be different.
Yes.
And they may not be complementing.
That's right.
Each other.
So they don't have to fulfill each other's needs, all of each other's needs.
Yes.
Yes.
Simple thing like which suburb to stay in or which city to live in, kind of stuff. So how do couples like come up with a solution where both their needs are being met? Or
that they may need a facilitation to a win. It's called a win-win. So in conflict, there's different ways to try to resolve. One, of course, is I win, you lose. The other one is, you know, I win, or compromise is another one. But we want to try to get to a win-win solution where both needs. In other words, you have to examine the needs. For example, you may say, I have a need to live in a warm climate. Right? Therefore, I want to move to Phoenix, Arizona. And you're telling your husband, we're going to Phoenix. Does it sound familiar?
Exactly the same dialogue as Kevin.
Sorry.
Phoenix, Arizona, exactly. Whoa.
Even the city was right.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh my God. I'm shocked.
That's so amazing.
Okay. So let's go through this. That's quite funny. So let's go through the scenario. I have to go to, your strategy is to go to Phoenix, okay? And your husband, he likes the cold here. What do you like the cold?
He wants to go to Phoenix.
Oh, he wants to go to Phoenix. All right, he wants to go to Phoenix, and you like it. You don't mind it, but you feel dedicated to Chicago. Chicago. And so the reason... Okay, so let's get to the need. He doesn't need to go to Phoenix. You have to ask him the question, why do you want to go to Phoenix? And he'll probably say...
It's better than going to India.
Yes.
No, what knee? We're trying to ask your why.
Warm weather for my knees and warmer weather.
So okay. So you can be outdoors more.
And so, all right. Because I miss my country.
Find another husband. What should you do?
No, I don't find the life.
I'm just joking. You have to figure out the needs. Your strategy is talking about going to India or going to Phoenix like that. So you figure out the needs. He has a need for warm climate. He has a need for warmth. He has a need for health. Okay. And you, why do you want to go to India?
I see India as a country that's far more warm. Like, you know.
Oh, you like warmth too.
Like human warmth. Human.
So here's a possible win-win. You get a new apartment, turn the heat up. Get him a membership in the gym because he likes to exercise. Fulfill, that's his need. You're fulfilling his need. I'm not saying that particular strategy. I'm saying you got to think outside the box. And you like warm people, so invite some of your family members to come here. To fulfill that particular need. There are other strategies. I'm just giving one example of a strategy that may fulfill both persons' needs. But also at the same time, if you leave America and if you go to Phoenix, then that probably won't fulfill your need for connection to your spiritual life, which to you is actually number one, right? Because you have your servant given to you by your spiritual master. So the other needs are important, and you have to figure out the priority of the needs. Your first priority is your spiritual life, but the other needs have to be taken care of. So maybe gym membership, maybe a hot tub for him, you know. Sound good?
I already have a gym membership. Hot tub is a good idea.
Yeah. Hot tub is a good idea, see? And then as far as communicating with all the relatives in India you want to be with, get yourself a big screen TV, go on Skype or... Yeah. I mean, if it's just a little tiny on the phone, it's really not satisfying. But I've seen people talking on big TVs, you know, big TVs with their family members. It's just like being there. Isn't it? So there's a strategy, right? I'm not saying it's going to work for you, but I just came up with an alternative strategy. If you think outside the box, you can come up with strategies in a married life where both persons' needs are met. Unless one person has to be a demon and they just want to eat meat everywhere in the house, you know, that's a different thing. Then you may... Actually, sometimes some couples, they say, "Well, here's the kitchen in the garage. You can cook your meat in the garage." So that may fulfill the needs. But there are ways. And we're over time. So thank you very much. And I appreciate everybody hearing so nicely. All glories to Prabhupada. And if you're interested in any more information, you can communicate with me, go on the internet, get a copy of my book, which I think a lot of people have already gotten. And I'm available by email. If anyone wants to communicate with me about NBC, empathic communication, or sometimes Krishna consciousness. I sometimes do that too. You know? All right, all the way to Prabhupada.